documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro-FM stations all across the country, and streaming from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. Vicki Davis is here as well, here on this 1st of July, 2017. And it's good to have you with us once again, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I noticed I didn't say that we were live today. This is a pre-recorded show. We are recording on Thursday because I'm going to be tied up for the next couple of Saturdays this week and next Saturday as well. I'm not quite sure what we're going to be doing for next Saturday, but we will have something here for the affiliates. And so maybe I'll put together a different kind of best of special or something as I have time. Or whatever the case, we'll have something here. And so you know the affiliates don't have to worry about reprogramming their automation or anything like that. I guess that seems like there was one other housekeeping item that I needed to talk about. Maybe it'll occur to me as time progresses, but anyway, Vicki Davis is here. Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning.
We had kind of an interesting thing happen this morning, and I told you a little bit of it. Went to power up the computers, and all of a sudden, I found out that Skype wouldn't let me in. And I thought, my worst fear has been realized. We got mostly Windows XP machines here because, I like the Windows XP platform. This, because Microsoft decided to pull the plug on the thing doesn't mean that I want to quit using it. And mostly, it takes about, five machines to do the show because we have one of them that I use for my main show material, and that's a Windows 7 machine. That's the only Windows 7 machine here. The rest of them are old XP machines that I bought used off the internet, believe it or not, at a significantly discounted price. And so one of them we run the phone bridge and the main Skype account from. And then there's another one that I use to run the actualities, the sound bites that we play during the show. And another one that runs the breaks, because all the breaks are ran here. Everything is sent prepackaged out to the networks. Everything's mixed right here in the studio here. So we have to have breaks. And that comes from a separate machine, which runs software that does that. And then directly behind me, as I sit at the broadcast desk here, there is another machine, another computer, that after all the processing that takes place in that equipment rack, where it goes through some audio processing, I've got a unit that does that. Then it goes into that machine behind me, which then encodes it for the stream, and also encodes it for the audio archive. And there's two different versions of the audio archive that, one of them is broadcast-friendly with the breaks in it, and one of them, the breaks are taken out for the podcast and for the website. So it's kind of a sophisticated operation that we have here. But anyway, I have two Skype accounts, and the main Skype account evidently was hacked. Because I noticed, for one thing, Microsoft locked me out of it, and for my own good, I think is what the message said. But I noticed when I thought, because it was going to be apparent that I wasn't going to easily recover from that before showtime. So I decided to look at the other account and see if I could get that one up and running, and sure enough, it worked fine. But then I noticed there was a link that had been sent from that other account to the backup account, or the second account, and that's when I realized, okay, this isn't just them pulling support for Windows XP. This is somebody evidently had gotten into the account. So if anybody's listening and you're on my main Skype account, don't click on that link. I don't know where it goes. I didn't send it. But
I clicked on it, and I don't remember where it went. It went out on the internet somewhere, but
well, I hope it wasn't anything nefarious.
Well, it doesn't seem to be. It didn't. I haven't noticed anything wrong with my machine, so.
Now, you might want to run a virus scan after the show or something, just in case, because I don't know what that was. It looked like a Google link of some kind, but...
Yeah, like a Google search link. No, I run scans on my machine, and I do have a virus protection thing. Yeah. I pay the extortion money every year.
Well, the problem with virus protection is it's becoming less and less effective. And in some cases, even, see, I don't run antivirus on any of my machines here. And the reason why I quit doing that, because number one, it tends to bog down the resources. It eats a lot of resources up. And for a second one, as time goes by, everything is going through TLS encryption. More and more web pages are, the antivirus protection companies are morphing their products into a catch-all, be-all security software, which tries to protect you against websites that have advertising and things like that that serve as vectors for malware that comes onto your machine. And the problem with that is increasingly the internet is moving toward TLS encryption. And antivirus software can't protect you from that without operating as a man in the middle, meaning that when it installs, it actually puts stuff in your browser, to make your browser trust it. In other words, it comes with its own security certificate that it installs in your browsers as a part of the install process. And then it gets to where your browser will trust its security certificate. And the reason why it's doing this is to crack open all TLS encryption traffic so that it can inspect your TLS encrypted, all the traffic that's going through from you to the website.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, any site that you go to that has that lock on it, that's an encrypted website, like ours at governedamerica.com, we have ours, we have TLS encryption employed. Now, without a certificate installed in your browser that trusts our certificate provider, you will not be able to get to the website because we do not accept unencrypted connections to our site. And the reason we did that, well, there's a couple of reasons we did that. The main thing is it's one of those sites that I log in through the interface, and we also have accounts on there. People can log in, and you don't want that stuff passing plain text over the internet because it could be intercepted and that sort of thing. So, but with this new software, now they're getting to where they're cracking open encryption. And they're inspecting the packets as they go back and forth from you to our site or any other encrypted website, like your bank, for instance. Which, if it's a reputable company that's producing the software, then that might be okay as long as they're doing it right. And therein lies the problem. Increasingly, these sites or these software companies, they're like anybody else. They're people that can make mistakes in the employment of technology that installs security certificates in your machine. So if they make a mistake somewhere in their software, now they've cracked open your encryption, and they're serving as a man in the middle. So if somebody, you're starting to see the problem.
Yeah.
If the software, the malware now is targeting the antivirus software, because if they can find a mistake inside that software, now They can stand as they're the man in the middle between you and your bank. Your browser trusts the software, and it's breaking open the encryption connection, and the antivirus is the man in the middle. So if it can get into the antivirus, it's got your banking information. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a bad or any other password that you might care about.
Well, yeah, I've said before, you know, they will eventually, we'll all be on dumb terminals and we won't be able to put anything on the internet or on the machine that we didn't type in ourselves.
Well, the dumb terminals, even that, even if we're on dumb terminals, they could lock it down, but it's only as secure as the person who designed it made it. And if they made mistakes, then it's going to be vulnerable to attack.
That's true. You're absolutely right.
It's, you know, the computers are going to be the death of us. I was just talking to Sam Britton about this the other day. We were, you know, I've been having some car trouble, which for me is not unusual. It seems like I got the worst luck in the world. And we had, I was driving home from work one night, and I ended up encountering a suicidal deer. And so the van has been in the body shop from the suicidal deer. So I drove my other car. Well, Michelle called me one day, and the car she's driving is a 2002 Pontiac, so it's not a new car either. And she says, I stopped at my parents' house, and she says, I shut the car off, and it wouldn't start again. And so I said, oh, no, you know, what is it now? So I said, well, you know, I'll look at it when I get home. So that night I got home and stopped in their driveway and went out and tried to start the car. Sure enough, you know, it didn't sound like it was getting fuel. And so I cranked on it a little bit, tried a couple of different things. Nothing would work. So I went home that night and we talked about it the next day. And what are we going to do Monday? So anyway, long story short, as short as possible, I ended up having to have the car towed. So I had to go Monday and rent her a car so she could get to work. And so anyhow, the car was towed to the shop, and the shop spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was wrong with this thing. And this is a case, and this is a good that I'm telling this story, because we talk about this all the time, Vicki, on the show. This is a classic example of how our technology is controlling us as opposed to us controlling our technology. This is a trend we're going to keep seeing more and more of. And again, this is a 2002. I have no idea what kind of Pandora's box evil lurks inside the newer cars. But what they ended up finding out, there was nothing really wrong with the car. What was wrong with the car is the programming in the computer had decided that somehow she was trying to steal the car.
Oh.
As Steve Gibson, the security expert, he likes to say, it's not a bug, it's a feature.
Right.
So, apparently, there is something in these models that if it detects, and God only knows how it determines this, but if it thinks that it's being stolen, there is a command it issues to the fuel injectors to not inject any fuel. And that's evidently what happened. Now, the recovery process is a lot of fun, too. Because in order to fix this thing, you have to put the key in the ignition, you turn it on, you bump the starter, and then and leave it in the on position for 10 minutes. Then, after 10 minutes, after the security light is blinking in your face for 10 minutes, then the security light will go off. Then you turn it off for 5 seconds. Then you wait for 5 seconds. Make sure you got to do every step right or you're going to be here all day. Then you turn it back on and wait for 10 minutes. Okay? Then you turn it back off after the security light quits flashing. And you wait for 5 seconds. You do this 3 times, and on the 3rd time, after you've turned it off for 5 seconds, you turn it back on, and then the car should start if you did everything correct. You're looking at a half an hour. And God help you if you've got any place to be. God help you if you're in a bad neighborhood and you've got a bunch of gangbangers after you trying to kill you. Hey, but no, they're not going to be able to steal your car. Now you're going to end up dead. Your tires may end up gone, but your car will be safe.
Oh, my God. I mean, what if you're on your way to the hospital, you know, your wife's having a baby or something?
Well, I hope you're good at delivering babies.
That is just, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is a classic example of how, of all the garbage they're putting on these cars. And again, this is not a new car. So what kind of garbage do, how far has it advanced since 2002?
Yeah. You know what? In the area that I'm living in, you know, they almost quit reporting accidents, you know, unless it was like on the freeway or something, you know, major traffic backup. But over the past, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 months, there has just been so many accidents in this area. And I'm wondering what's going on, you know, because I have suspicions that it has to do somehow with the technology and the vehicles. And, you know, I don't know, you know, maybe somebody learned how to hack into them. There are flawed parts, but there have been more accidents in this area in the past 6 months than I have seen for years.
Huh. Well, I wonder how much of it is people on their smartphones, because there's a lot of that going on. I know that.
Well, that's a possibility, I guess. That's a possibility, but I don't know. I wouldn't even think that. There's just been too many.
Well, I don't know. I can tell you that there's been a lot of times that I've been in traffic and people have wandered into my lane. I don't know how many times this has happened, where people have wandered into my lane for no apparent reason, and finally correct after I'm starting to sweat, you know, because they're coming at me, and then they finally correct at the last minute.
Uh-huh.
And I just have a sense that they're probably not watching the road. And then, you know, a lot of times there's, I mean, the cops will tell you stories about how the light will turn green, and people will literally sit there because they're not paying attention to the light. I mean, the other side, and you know this is by design, they have worked on this to make people so addicted to these things. And what comes to mind is that that speech that Aldous Huxley gave at Berkeley. I'll have to dig that speech back up, because we've got the speech. But he gave a speech at Berkeley where he talked about how they were going to make servitude so attractive, so desirable for people, that they would love their servitude. And I think this is where we are today. People can't give it up.
I totally agree. And I think that's what all this sports stuff on TV is. It's part of the servitude, the occupation of your mind on things that are not important.
Yeah, and sports has been around for a long time. But I mean, and that is certainly a pacification of the masses. And they've always had, the other side has always had a pacification. You know, we talk about bread and circuses and things like that. But here's the deal. I mean, it's gotten to the point where people are much more satisfied and happy. I think there's something that happens in the brain. I think there's a drug that's released in the brain, you know, in the pleasure centers or something. I look at how addicted people are to this. that it's got to be something akin to heroin or some kind of drug that, that gives pleasure, that when they're on these things, doing what they're doing, literally, reality doesn't matter anymore. The world around them doesn't matter anymore. I mean, it's extremely to the point where, very antisocial behavior, where you're looking at somebody and trying to talk to them, trying to convey a message to them, and they will not make eye contact with you. We've never been at this place before, as far as I know, in the United States. I mean, with technology to the point where people are literally in the matrix, and they don't want to face the reality out in the outside world. It's kind of terrifying in a way.
Well, it is. And computers do tend to do that to you. You know, if you don't have to think and everything you do is on the computer and the computer tells you what to do or, you know, provides you with the, now it's an entertainment value and you don't have to think. It does dull your mind. It is kind of a, it does have a dulling effect. And I have to say, between television and the internet and these cell phones and everything, it does seem like we have a zombified society.
Yeah, and I don't want to sound like I'm some sort of a Luddite or something that, you know, I mean, I love technology.
So do I.
I mean, we wouldn't be able to be sitting here having this conversation without it. I mean, I just said I have 5 computers here that I use to do the show. I mean, I enjoy technology. But I also recognize that it has to have a place. And I like technology that I can control. I don't want technology controlling me, because this is exactly the technocratic slavery that we've been talking about on this broadcast ever since we've been aware of the term technocracy.
I totally agree. And that's my problem with all the new software, is that they're making the machines so that I am less and less able to control it.
Yeah, you're locked down.
And I have to change what I want to do, accommodate myself to the machine. And I don't like that.
Yeah.
You know, I want it to do what I want it to do. It's my machine. I bought it. I paid for it. And, when I got my first machine, back in 1985, it was an IBM AT, and IBM produced full manuals on the machine. They told you absolutely everything about that machine. And so you could actually program it yourself. You could modify it if you wanted to, if you were that into tech stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now they barely give you, all they give you is like a piece of paper, you know, your warranty information, and that's it.
And cars.
They don't tell you anything about the machine.
Cars, we were just talking about automobiles. Cars are the same way. I mean, back in the day, you could work on a car. You could, if you understood how a car works, and, you know, the basic premise is pretty simple, you could work on a car. Now, they're making these things where it increasingly is running on, they're running on computer code. They're running on sophisticated algorithms and programming wonderful anti-theft programs into them and all kinds of things that operate on the emissions systems and everything. To the point where you can't get in there. And some of this is government regulated, I have to say. Some of this stuff, due to the government regulations about fuel efficiency and that sort of thing, from what I understand, they have to do certain things to control fuel emissions or emissions, but also fuel efficiency and that sort of thing, which necessitates being able to control acceleration. So there's a lot of things going on here with cars but all of it is controlled by computers. And the problem here is that when you're driving a car now, especially the newer models, which will eventually someday be the older models, you're having, you're not really driving the car. Already, you know, we talk about self-driving cars, and maybe we can get into some of that today. But you're not driving the car. The one that's actually driving it is the computer. You're driving it by proxy. And this is a whole different world.
I think I told you about my senior citizen friend who has a vehicle that when she crosses the line on either side, you know, left or right, it will beep at her. And so when you ride in a car with her, it's like beep, beep. And so she corrects and goes to the other side and you get beep, beep, you know. And so you're right. I mean, the computer in her vehicle is basically driving the car. She's just sitting there at the wheel. But it makes you kind of crazy riding with her because of all the beeping.
Yeah, and then they nag you to wear the seatbelt. Wow.
I hate that.
Yeah.
I don't like being told what to do.
Exactly. We are becoming slaves to our technology. This is exactly, I think what, this is what Professor, the Unabomber guy warned everybody about in his manifesto.
Oh, yeah. I forget what his name is. I'll think of it during the break, I bet.
Yeah. He was a professor. Maybe I'll think of it, too. Anyway, bottom of the hour. Let's go ahead and take the break. Unbelievable how fast the time's going. Stay with us, folks. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. And we'll be back in a moment. Back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. And it continues to be the 1st of July, 2017. And by the way, I just have to remind everybody, if you're trying to call the toll-free number, you're going to get the voicemail that's connected to the toll-free number because today's broadcast is it's a new broadcast as of July 1st, 2017. But it is a pre-recorded broadcast, unfortunately, today because I'm tied up for the next couple of Saturdays. So just be mindful of that. We will try to have something fresh every week, but once in a while, there's things that I got to do. So anyway, before the break, and the name of the Unabomber was Theodore Kaczynski. That's the name.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's the name we were trying to remember. So anyway, I don't know. I didn't mean to make this a long-winded dissertation, but I think it's important to remind people, you know, point out when we encounter these situations that this is what we've been warning people about, and this is what other people have been trying to convey over the years, how we're losing control. This is what technocracy and the technocratic tyranny is all about.
Yeah, and I know that Congress has lost control of our government. They've contracted out all of the systems of our government to private corporations, so they basically don't control our government anymore. They just vote what they're told to vote, I believe. You know, the whole Obamacare system. They paid one company, Serco, I think, over $1 billion for the rollout of Obamacare. And what Obamacare actually is a computer system. It's a computerized system that controls the insurance market for health care, the market for health care. And I think that they tried to manage the subsidies for health care through the, quote, market in a system of managed competition that actually was the idea of a guy named Alain Enthoven in the late 80s or 90s. But so the whole idea for Obamacare was actually came from the Republican side of the aisle. And last week I watched a video in which one of the members of Congress, a senator, said that Lincoln Chafee was the first one to propose this idea of the creation of the marketplace, you know, for health insurance.
Yeah, you mean that marketplace website that wouldn't stay up, that was DDoSing itself? That's what's funny about it is all these characters are working so hard to build all of these sophisticated computer systems, and they couldn't even build a website that wouldn't DDoS itself.
Yeah. It
doesn't make you very optimistic for the future, does it?
No. And besides that, it changes our form of government. I mean, that's not capitalism. That's it's more like state-controlled capitalism, which is really communism. I mean, that's what the Chinese have is a state capitalism, but it's not really capitalism.
Yeah, it's so. Something akin to the Matrix. I mean, I think we were talking last week about predictive programming and how Hollywood puts in these movies. There's a lot of insiders in Hollywood, and they put in the movies, in the entertainments that you see on TV and also at the theater, if those of you that go there, and I don't give them my money, but a lot of people do, and they tell you right what they're going to do right in the movies. And it's amazing to me, I never watched Star Trek, for instance, until I was at the NBC affiliate working in Master Control, and I was forced to switch it. I always thought it looked stupid when I flipped across the channel or something, and but then I was warned by my fellow operators. Many people thought the same thing, and then they were roped in when they sat in that chair that you're sitting in. And so, over time, sitting there, being paid to sit there and switch the local breaks, that was back when we actually did that. Now automation does that too. But anyway, I kind of got interested in it, and what I found is all the technology that they put in Star Trek, and the one that really I always thought was the best was Next Generation. But the technology that they put in those things was really a predictive programming type of deal for what we have going on today. I think they were developing the technologies back then. They knew where they're going to take society, and they implemented it accordingly.
Well, they knew back in the 1960s that there was going to be what they envisioned it, the internet, as a library access system, you know, where you could access information. I don't think they really could envision totally what the internet has become, but they did envision it that far, which back in the 1960s was a tremendous leap from where people were, where the majority of the people were.
Right.
And so that's when I believe it was the Carnegie Foundation funded the futurists, you know, to try and envision the future for people so that they could understand where the society was going. And I know we've talked about 2001 Space Odyssey, that movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a movie produced in the future, you know, with an idea towards the future. So they knew for a long time before anybody else, the majority of people, were even aware of what a computer was.
Yeah, what I'm talking about as far as predictive programming is, for instance, the communicators in Star Trek. They had these, like, they looked like folding, you know, flip phones, and they called them communicators. We didn't have those back then. But, you know, it was, they foresaw that in the Star Trek episodes. Another thing is that, you know, aboard the Enterprise, they have a computer that they just talk to, and the computer does certain tasks. Well, you've got Siri now. Apple's got Siri. Google's got their thing. Okay, Google. When you say okay, Google, it responds to you. So, I mean, there's a lot of things like that that have been put into place that were first introduced to the general population as a predictive programming type of foreshadowing of what was to come.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, I just think it's interesting. Anyway, one thing that I wanted to touch upon, Vicki, changing the subject a little bit here, the Free Thought Project has just come out with an article on June 28th, FBI agent indicted for lying about the killing of Lavoie Finicum. Did you see this?
Yes, I did. I surely did. It's been a real hot topic on Facebook, as you might imagine.
Yeah. What are they saying? Well, let me just share a little of this for the listeners who are not familiar with it. They say, late Tuesday evening, it was announced that an unnamed FBI agent involved in the killing of Robert Lavoie Finicum has been indicted. The agent is accused of lying about shooting at Finicum in 2016 when officers arrested the leaders of an occupation of a federal wildlife refuge in rural Oregon. In March of 2016, it was announced that multiple FBI agents were under investigation for their role in the death of Finicum. For over a year, Finicum's family has waited for answers, and on Tuesday night, they received a glimpse into the corruption surrounding the death of their beloved father and husband. An FBI agent now faces allegations of making false statements with the intent of obstructing justice, according to reports. He is to be named on Wednesday. Do we have the name?
I have his name. His name is W. Joseph Astarita.
Okay.
Astarita.
Okay.
And he's pleaded guilty. Did you get to listen to Billy Williams, the what do they call him? The district attorney for the Oregon district.
No, he couldn't even help himself.
They're still lying about the whole incident.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
It was absolutely amazing.
Well, it doesn't really amaze me. Because every time,
like, they're pathological liars.
That's how they roll. That's how they roll. Anyway, they say in this article, according to the Oregonian, investigators concluded that one agent fired at Finicum's truck, hitting it in the roof and missing on the second shot. A state trooper later described to investigators seeing two rifle casings in the area where the FBI agents were posted, but detectives called to investigate didn't find the casings, police reports indicated. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Is it Deschutes County?
Deschutes County.
Deschutes County Sheriff alleged as Finicum left his truck, an FBI agent shot twice at Finicum, but none of the FBI hostage team's members said they had discharged their firearms. It appears that the agent attempted to hide the fact that they shot at him, and now they are being called to task for it. Well, yeah, and will the media report this stuff? See, and here you go. I mean, they released that fuzzy police video, very blurry. I can tell you right now, there's no way that they don't have very crystal clear, in this day of surveillance, very crystal clear, high-definition video technology, and yet that was the best they could do, is produce that very highly blurry helicopter footage of Lavoie being shot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that right there.
Yeah, I've seen better videos out there.
Of course. And how long did it take them to produce this this work of fiction?
The whole thing probably would have never been investigated except for Shauna Cox's video that she took inside the truck.
Yeah.
They were shooting at the truck before before Lavoie even got out. Lavoie got out of the truck, to stop the shooting at the other people.
Yep. smartest thing she ever did was have that camera rolling.
Yeah, that was. That was good thinking on her part.
I'm surprised they didn't take it and destroy it, but they didn't probably, I don't know, for whatever reason. You know, they're not infallible. They make mistakes. But anyway, I hope that these people are prosecuted to the fullest that they possibly can, but with today's courts, I don't have a whole lot of confidence in courts, and we talk about that all the time, too.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, you know, that brings us really to our big story of the week.
You don't have to be right. You don't have to be true. Just make something up. We'll call it news. Share it with your family. Share it with your friends. As long as they like it, it'll end up on CNN. News, fake news. Fake news, fake news. Fake news, fake news. Fake news, fake news.
Well, CNN is in big trouble. Even though they don't really need any help self-destructing. They've done a lot of things here in the last couple of weeks. Last week we talked about how they were involved in a big scandal with this coming out with a completely bogus story about one of Trump's associates, Scaramucci or whatever his name was. And now we've had the fallout. I don't know if you've been following this or not. But they've had three so-called journalists, and I can't call them journalists, but three so-called journalists resign as a result of that incident. Thomas Frank, and he supposedly, I guess he won there's a Pulitzer Prize winner, Eric Lichtblau, recently hired away from the New York Times, and Lex Harris. They've all evidently, I guess, resigned. But, why were they forced out? Well, turns out, you remember last week I said that I smelled that there must have been a lawsuit here?
Mm-hmm.
Or a threat of a lawsuit? Well, turns out I was right. The New York Post reports CNN faced the $100 million lawsuit over this botched Russia story.
Oh, wow. So, is that from Scaramucci?
Yeah, I believe so. They say the specter of a $100 million libel suit scared CNN into retracting a poorly reported story that slimed an ally of President Trump's and forcing out the staffers responsible for it, the Post has learned. The cable network's coverage of Trump's transition team member Anthony Scaramucci came amid federal scrutiny of a corporate parent Time Warner's pending purchase by AT&T. Yeah, see, that's the other thing, is they're trying to do this merger, and it's coming at a very bad time for them. All these scandals. But in the widespread belief among media executives that CNN President Jeff Zucker can't survive a merger, CNN immediately caved after Scaramucci, a financier and frequent network guest, cried foul and threatened to take legal action, sources said Tuesday. So, as soon as I saw them retract and apologize, I knew there must have been a lawsuit threat.
I didn't know that there was a merger pending. That's very interesting.
Yeah,
I wonder if that's, you know, that guy, the CNN guy, was so open in talking about how it's a fake story. It almost seems like kind of a poison pill for the merger.
Well, maybe it is. I don't know. But I don't know what to say about that.
I don't either, because on the one hand you're discrediting your organization, but you kill the merger deal.
Well, I doubt it's going to kill the merger deal. What it may do is make more favorable merger relations with for AT&T, who they're talking about merging with. But I don't know. I mean, you look at Verizon. Was it Verizon that was merged recently with Yahoo, I believe?
Really? I didn't know that. You know what? They've got to stop all of these mergers. I mean, you know, we're going to end up with like five or six corporations that own absolutely everything.
Yeah. It's already like that in the media.
Yeah, which is what I've said. I mean, it's a game, this whole globalization scheme, it's a game of king of the hill. And whoever gets the biggest, fastest is going to dominate. And so there's, you know, it's all this pressure to merge and get bigger just to survive.
Yeah, the Verizon thing was, it's been a long time coming. It's been actually in the process, in the works for a long time. The problem is that they've had a lot of trouble, Yahoo has, in the meantime, while the whole negotiation deal is going on, all of these security scandals have taken place where they have had their accounts of their users compromised over and over again. In one case, they have had a massive security breach where people's accounts were hacked or at least compromised in some way, where, you know, some hacker got into their system, into the Yahoo system, I mean, and compromised all these accounts, and they never said a word for 2 years. 2 years. They didn't say a word to people.
Wow.
And so after that came out, I mean, because they didn't want to let people know because it would be embarrassing for them. The problem is, by not letting people know, you allow them to just sit there and be compromised. People use their email for a lot of different things, including sensitive material. Once an email is hacked, I mean, a lot of times other accounts are connected with your email, password recoveries for other accounts. Some people even use it for their banking information, which I think is a very weak link in hopefully financial institutions have evolved enough security-wise to not do that anymore. But I don't know. I mean, if somebody can get into your email, they can get into a lot of things. Potentially. And they never said a word for 2 years. And then the thing is it happened more than once. Right after that, I mean, it was announced, and then the number kept growing. That's the other thing. Is first it was this amount of accounts, then later on, actually it was this amount. You know, it's like in the billions in terms of the number of accounts. It was a massive story. And this is right when Verizon was going to buy them, and in fact, still went through with the deal. I think probably under a better, more favorable terms, because, like, look, Yahoo's already has been dying a slow death. It's like rabies, you know. They've been dying a very slow death because
I used Yahoo for probably, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years. But at the point when they wanted to collect all of your personal information, you know, what's your address, what's your phone number, you know, all that information, and they wouldn't let you be in the groups without it. Mm-hmm. I just left Yahoo. I just quit. But they had the best platform, and I think they probably had the biggest share of the email audience. But then, you know, when they started doing that, I think they probably lost a lot of people.
Yeah, I would say the more savvy people like yourself probably left. There are some people that'll just blindly follow along. You know? they're rule followers.
I can follow the rules.
That's right, citizen. Anyway, so getting back to the CNN thing for a second, though, now they have their executive editor is demanding to review all future Russia-related stories, no exceptions, and so that's probably what they should have done to begin with. But then, you know, even though CNN doesn't need any help self-destructing, they did get some anyway, thanks to James O'Keefe over there at Project Veritas. Now, he's done us a tremendous service here, and it really isn't surprising what's going on. Not to those of us who understand the media and understand what they're all about. You know, they engage in dishonesty, and it's a matter of routine. But anyway, James O'Keefe sent his undercover reporters into CNN to gain the trust of their employees. One of the employees that opened up was John Bonifield. He's a senior supervising producer at CNN who, not realizing that he was secretly being recorded, talked quite candidly about the Russian meme that CNN is pushing. Now, I got some audio here of this, and it's pretty enlightening. First, you're going to hear the undercover journalist with the Project Veritas undercover reporter. And then it'll be CNN's John Bonifield.
So you believe like the Russia thing's a little crazy, right?
Even if Russia was trying to swing an election, we try to swing their elections. We're in our CIA and doing it all the time. Like, we're out there trying to manipulate governments. Like, you win because you know the game and you play it right. She didn't play it right.
Okay, that was, he says, you win the game because you don't play it right. Or you win the game because you play it right. He's talking about Hillary Clinton and why she lost the election. It had nothing to do with the Russians hacking the election. It had everything to do with the fact that she didn't play the game right. So I'll tell you what, we're at the top of the hour. I'll continue with some of this on the other side of the break. I'm sure that there's a lot of people talking about this, but I feel like for posterity's sake and for documentation's sake, we need to talk about it, because this is the kind of stuff that we've been telling people for years is going on. And frankly, for me, it's very personal, because I've spent the last 13 years of my life behind this microphone doing the job that the mainstream media won't do. And so, you know, it's kind of personal with me. Anyway.
Yeah, I would say me too.
Yeah, you too. And a lot of other people are in the same boat with us. Stay with us, folks. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. Hour number two is straight ahead.
Crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is hour number two of Govern America. It continues to be the 1st of July, 2017, and we're getting right back into it here. By the way, I wanted to remind people, we are pre-recording the show on Thursday of this week. It is a new show, but it is a pre-recorded show. So if you're calling the toll-free number, you're going to get a recording. And that's just, you can leave us a message there, but unfortunately today you won't be able to get on the air, because we can't do that with a pre-recorded show. In a couple weeks we'll be back live, and I do miss the phone calls, but it is what it is, folks. Anyway, we're talking about this situation with CNN, and a lot of people are probably talking about this as well, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I think it's important, because they like to point out how uncredible we are. They like to talk about us being conspiracy theorists and all of this stuff, and they're crashing and burning because of their own partisanship and their own stupidity and their own complete disregard and abandonment of the truth. So it's a little bit irritating for me.
Yeah. Well, you know what? They've been doing that for a long time, because the first of... fake story. The first time I read about fake news, I forget what it was that I was researching, but I found out that story, I think it was about the Corvairs blowing up, or the gas tanks blowing up if they were hit from behind or something.
Oh, yeah.
The, I'm not sure how accurate the statistics were that they were giving, but what they showed on TV as, you know, showing a crash and fire, that was faked. They set that up and did it, showed it as if it was real, like a real accident. And I don't know, maybe it was naive on my part, but I found that pretty shocking.
And they didn't say it was a reenactment or anything?
No, they did not say that it was a reenactment. And as a matter of fact, it didn't. It came out in the lawsuit with GM. GM sued or was sued by a family. And anyway, it did come out that was a it was staged. It was not real.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know this little nugget.
Yeah, I have it somewhere on my hard drive.
You know, we were talking before the break. We were playing audio from this James O'Keefe Project Veritas investigation. Now James O'Keefe, here is an example of a person who is a real journalist and who employs a real journalist. This is what journalism is. He's going undercover. He's unveiling and revealing truth that's hidden and bringing it out into light, and using documentation to do it. Now, that is what we need more of, especially in light of this whole media thing. The mass media. Mass media is a poison, and the people need to understand that it's a poison. You know, I'm gratified at how far we've come in the Patriot Truth movement. The what would you call this thing? You know, I remember back years ago when I first started in this in earnest. I mean, people had no idea what the Hegelian dialectic was. People had no idea, you know, that the pretense, you know, false flags and all this stuff, this was not mainstream. And yet now we've come so far that a lot of people, it's been brought into the mainstream now. And even to the point now where people are not trusting the media now. And I think part of that is the media's own fault, because they're not pretending to be nonpartisan anymore. I mean, before they used to pretend. Now it's like all pretension has been abandoned, and they're just going whole hog toward...
Right, and you know what? It's no longer just withholding and spinning information in a particular way. It's just outright lying.
Yes.
And so what we have is propaganda media.
Yeah, and we've always had that, but and they probably have been making up stories all along, very much the same way. You know, I don't know. I think it's gotten worse because
it's much worse.
They used to name sources. They used to have sources for their materials. They used to even in the old like when you look at All the President's Men, the movie. All the President's Men, about the Watergate break-in. And that's centered around the Washington Post. And they, in the movie, were trying to get... Now, whether the movie's right or not, but they were trying to get people to go on the record. They were saying, let's see if we can get them to go on the record. You know, a lot of people were anonymous, and they got in trouble for using anonymous sources in the movie. And again, I'm not trying to portray... That the but I mean that was an issue, is my point, and that was an issue in the movie that they were trying to get people to go on the record. Now they don't bother to try to get people to go on the record. It's let's just cite an anonymous source, say it's so, and we can steer the narrative whatever way we want. The problem is it's all made up. It's all bull crap, and this audio demonstrates this perfectly. Now, before the break, he was talking about Hillary Clinton and, you know, you win the game because you play the game right. She didn't play the game right. So he goes on to expand upon how this Russian meme is such a ratings bonanza for CNN, to the point where CEO Jeff Zucker insisted in a meeting that they keep hammering it. he also talks about how cynical he and many of his colleagues, and this is, again, this is a producer, a managing producer, I think. I mean, he's a supervisor, one of their top guys, I guess. He also talks about how cynical he and many of his colleagues are about the news business, because all the things that they learned in journalism school are nothing like the real world. In fact, the word he uses to describe the ethics they teach in journalism school is, oh, that's adorable. That's so adorable.
Well, you know what? I want to point something out here.
Yeah.
The same thing happened with the stock market. You know, the new innovative ways of doing things. Let's just turn the young people loose. They found out that the new ways of doing things that these young people came up with are the old ways that existed before, and it's just corruption. And it's the same with everything. They've turned everything in our society over to young people because of this technology boom, you know, and the quote innovation, and everything is corrupt.
Yep.
You know, and I'm not blaming it on the ethics per se of the young people, but our society has lost all sense of morality and ethics.
Yeah, and that's by design.
It's because the older people, the experienced people in the business, just turned everything over to young people, and young people don't necessarily spend a whole lot of time thinking about ethics.
It's like that English sociologist Benjamin Kidd said, give us the young. Give us the young, and we will create a whole new society in a single generation. And I'm paraphrasing here, but that's close to what he said.
Right, society of the fly, or Lord of the Flies. We have a society of the flies.
Society of the flies. That's right. So anyway, continuing with the audio here.
The more CNN constantly, like, Russia this, Russia that.
Because it's ratings.
Because it's ratings?
Our ratings are incredible right now. So, my boss, I shouldn't say this, my boss a couple days yesterday, we were having a discussion about this dental shoot, and he's like, I just want you to know what we're up against here. And he goes, just to give you some context, President Trump pulled out of the climate accords, and for a day and a half we covered the climate accords, and the CEO of CNN said in our internal meeting, he said, good job, everybody, covering the climate accords. But we're done with it. Let's get back to Russia.
The CEO?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So even the climate accords, he was like, okay, a day or so, but we're moving back to Russia.
So it's, I mean, I understand. It's all ratings, right?
Oh, it's a business. It's a business. People are like, the media has, like, an ethical... But... all the nice cutesy little ethics that used to get talked about in journalism school.
No, it's noisy here, so I hope you can hear this. But he's saying it's not all the nice little ethics, the cute little ethics that we learned in journalism school. It's all adorable.
You're just like, that's adorable. That's adorable. Yeah, this is a business, especially cable news. You know. Cable news isn't the New York Times, and it's not even like NBC News. It's NBC News still gets 20 million viewers a night. Cable news is getting a million. So, they gotta do what they gotta do to make their money, I think. And so I love the news business, but I
find it so fascinating.
I'm very cynical about it. At the same time, so are most of my colleagues.
Yeah, it's like...
I'm not alone.
Okay, I don't know. Could you make all that out, Vicky?
Yeah, I could hear it.
Okay, good. Yeah, very cynical about the news business, even though he loves the news business. But they know that what they're doing is wrong. They know that they're engaging in misinformation every single day.
Uh-huh.
After getting a tour of the newsroom, the undercover journalist from the Project Veritas asks him again about the Russian story, and he doubles down and says, you know, and admits that the Russian story is BS.
I think that there are a lot of like liberal CNN viewers who want to see Trump really get scrutinized, and I think if we would have behaved that way with President Obama and scrutinized everything that he...
Okay, sorry, this is not the clip I thought it was. That's the next clip. This clip, they were he's talking about the ideology at the network.
...doing with as much scrutiny as we apply to Donald Trump, I think our viewers would have been turned off. I think they would have thought like we were attacking him, but I think our viewers right now... And I'm not saying all of our viewers are like super liberals. Right. I think there's just a lot of them, and...
So Trump's good for business, you're saying?
Trump is good for business right now.
Trump is good for business. If we had applied the same kind of scrutiny to Obama, our viewers would have been turned off.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's absolute honesty from the inside of the business.
Yeah, when they're not on camera, they're honest.
In the 1990s, they decided that, you see... When I was growing up, news was overhead, done as a public service. At some point in the late 80s or 90s, they thought that news should be generating a profit. Mm-hmm. It's just like everything else in our society. Everything should generate a profit. And all of the sharing and caring messages, like that young guy said, that's adorable. But the fact is that they have turned our country into a business. Businesses are businesses. And everything has to generate a profit somewhere.
Yeah.
And so
here we are. With information.
And so we have a vicious, dishonest society.
Exactly.
But honestly, you think the whole Russia is just like bullshit.
Could be bullshit. I mean, it's mostly bullshit right now. Like, we don't have any big, giant proof. But then they say, well, there's still an investigation going on. And you're like, yeah. I don't know. If you're finding something, here we'd know about it. The way these leaks happen... It'd leak. If there was something really good, it would leak.
Yeah. It would have leaked before voting, I would say. If anything was good out there, it would have came out already.
Yeah, the leaks keep leaking, and there's so many great leaks, and it's amazing, and I just refuse to believe that if they had something really good like that wouldn't leak, because we've been getting all these other leaks, so...
Now, you're hearing the voice of the CNN producer. This is a guy, again, who is a high-ranking CNN producer. His job title leads me to believe that he is supervising other producers. So he is saying that if there was something to this Russian story, that it would have leaked. He says, we don't have any hard proof.
I just feel like they don't really have it, but they want to keep digging.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the president is probably right to say, like... Look, you are witch hunting me. Like, you have no smoking gun. You have no real proof.
What do you think of that, Vicky? The president is right to say that that the media is witch hunting him.
Yeah. Well, you know, CNN was started by Ted Turner, wasn't it?
Yes. He doesn't own it anymore. Okay. But
yeah, he had to sell it, but you don't change a big corporate culture like that overnight. I'll bet you there's still loyalties to Ted Turner at
well,
the top.
Well, I think it's worse than when Ted Turner owned it, honestly. I'm wondering if even Ted Turner, as liberal as he is, would have stood for the kind of partisan garbage that they're engaging in now. I mean, I think Ted Turner at least liked to make the network look like it was objective, because they've become ineffective. The whole thing is in complete disarray. I mean, their ratings might be good, but how many of their viewers really trust them? Unless it's just a bunch of, you know, extreme leftist lapdogs who just suck up everything they put out, which I'm sure there's a huge percentage of those. But really, how effective are they it's just become a big echo chamber. It's you're reinforcing the ideas I've already believed. If I'm a leftist you're not really changing anything. But this thing here blows open any pretense. I mean, you and I have been telling this audience from day one that this whole Russian thing, there's no proof to it. They have never... I'm open. If I see some concrete proof, then, you know, maybe I'll change my mind. But I have not seen anything because they've got nothing, apparently. But yet they've, you know, and you hear the CIA and, you know, Clapper and people like him try to talk about the hacking thing as if, well, you know, it's a pattern. It's the pattern of the Russians and things like that. No, there's an awful lot of conjecture here, especially since I understand how computers work and IP addresses can be spoofed through proxies. You can't really concretely prove any of this. And going to war because of some cyber attack, which you don't even know really where the origin came from, is a pretty weak and stupid reason to go to war.
Well, yeah, but also there's that the intelligence agencies were really not relying on the hacking part of the story. They were looking at the dossier, and I was reading that dossier was the product of
the Democrats.
A guy from a former MI6 spy. Okay, now that was really intriguing to me. Because we have a lot of problems that are below the radar with the City of London, with Great Britain. And, you know, we have a lot of British people over here that are supposedly our friends trying to help us out, but we have a lot of enemies over there. And beginning, I'd say, with Tony Blair, who provided the yellow cake story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a false, got us into war over there. But so this MI6 spy story and the hacking, it all kind of fits in with the plan that we know that they have, which is to link up all of the intelligence agencies around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that we have a global Stasi.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's not very comforting.
No, it isn't.
But it's just,
you know,
another
and that's why
example.
I do what I do, because people... especially back when I started, people just never thought about computer systems. They didn't understand, and I think for the most part, they still don't understand the power of a computer system. They understand from their personal point of view, you know, that it has their information in it, but what can be done in the way of control with a computer system would boggle people's minds if they understood the full scope of the systems that are being developed.
Yeah.
It is like the Matrix, you know. Total control, and they can, you know, create illusions for you.
There you go. Well, I got a couple more of these CNN things, and we'll get off of this and go on to something else. But Tuesday of this week... another Project Veritas journalist approached CNN's Van Jones. Now, of course, you know, Van Jones, the former Obama person, you know, very closely connected, operated inside the Obama administration before he was at CNN. Well, Van Jones was standing outside the building, and this Project Veritas undercover reporter, investigator, approached him, and evidently they had met at some previous venue. And so Van Jones recognized him. So they smiled and shook hands and got to talking. And Van Jones let his guard down and admitted, contrary to what he says on CNN, that there is absolutely nothing to the Russian story.
Hey, man. We met in Palm Springs a few years back.
Good to see you, man. You good?
Yeah. How you been? What are you doing? What do you think's going to happen this week? I mean, with the whole Russia thing.
The Russia thing is just a big nothing burger.
Really? You don't think that...
Okay, at that point they were interrupted by somebody else. But he called it a big nothing burger. The Russia thing is a big nothing burger.
Yeah.
And anyway, and finally, when you just thought CNN couldn't sink any lower, they held a Facebook. Oh, this is a different thing altogether, which I think is fascinating at the level that they. But now they held a Facebook live propaganda event where they were promoting refugee resettlement, Vicky. And they had a panel of people on there to talk about it. And, well, Elmo from Sesame Street was part of their refugee resettlement panel.
An extremely exciting Facebook Live here for you now. We're talking about an amazing project that is bringing the wonders of Sesame Street to refugees in different war-torn places across the world. And we have some really exciting guests with us. Facebook users, you will want to be asking questions. Start putting them in the comments section. Let me introduce our guests. We have David Miliband, who is, of course, the CEO of the IRC, the International Rescue Committee, who have teamed up with Sesame Street in this venture. We have Sherry Weston, who is the head of global impact for the Sesame Workshop. And last but not least, I have to say this is a real treat. I get to interview lots of exciting people. But Elmo, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Elmo. Hi, everybody.
Elmo, can I just start by asking you, because I know you went to visit a refugee camp in Jordan, right?
Yes.
Back in February?
Yes.
What was it like?
It was really wonderful. Oh, Elmo and Miss Sherry went to Jordan together?
We did.
And it was really wonderful because Elmo got to meet a lot of new friends.
A lot of new friends? And did you find that the Syrian little girls and little boys were a lot like your friends here in America?
Really were. It was very interesting because they like to play and learn,
right,
just like Elmo and all of his friends at Sesame Street.
And they loved Elmo. They loved meeting Elmo.
It was a really good time.
Well, you're pretty lovable, Elmo. I mean, Sherry, tell us a little bit more about this project. Why is this important? And
that's enough of that.
That is
it's playtime.
So disgusting.
It's playtime. But hey, if you consider probably the average IQ of their audience, it's probably very fitting that they do this. I mean, look, this is the crowd we're talking about that has to have their safe spaces, and eliminate all the microaggressions and make sure they're not triggered, you know. So why not invite Elmo in to cater to this crowd? Doesn't it just...
I don't know. I can't even imagine ever a time in my life, even when I was a teenager, when I wouldn't have been disgusted by the blatant propaganda and the use of a preschooler's character that's supposed to teach the ABCs.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm incensed that they would propagandize young people like that.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, I don't know. I'm speechless. I really am speechless. And for a talk show host, that's not a good thing.
I know. I hadn't heard that. So that's, I heard somebody talking about it, but I hadn't heard it.
So moving along here, we had a situation. By the way, we've made a lot of changes to the website at governamerica.com, having given the website out. And, of course, Vicky's website is thetechnocratictyranny.com and channelingreality.com. The website, I added a bunch of links up there under the What We're Reading category. And one of those is Alec Exposed. And I kind of get the impression that Alec Exposed might be a little leftist. But they are exposing the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is on the right. And I'm not right wing or left wing. I try to operate outside the dialectic. But I do understand the importance of exposing these organizations that are doing nefarious things. And one of those, and the reason why I brought that Alec Exposed site up, is I came across an updated information about the Constitutional Convention. There was a link off of that which talked about how the Koch brothers have encountered some problems. There's a few states that have rescinded their calls for a constitutional convention. And they're going to be... So this thing evidently is still in play. They're still working to try to get the necessary number of states. And, of course, can we count the states that rescind their calls? Apparently, somebody must be. So...
Well, that's good. Anytime I see the Koch brothers' names, I'm a conservative, but the Koch brothers, everything they do, the message is directed at patriots, but it serves the interests of the Koch brothers.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. All right, let's take the bottom of the hour break. We'll continue in just a moment. This is Govern America. We're back. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. As we continue on here, I see that from Futurism, Hawaii becomes the first state to pass a bill in support of universal basic income. This is something that we were talking about before, Vicki. This is a trend, something that I think is a major step toward communism, because you know, if the government's in charge of the wages and providing a safety net, we've seen how well that's worked with other things, Social Security. They're always threatening to take it away from you. You know,
inevitable. It was inevitable because with the systems, the way that they're allowing these computer systems, the way that the global economy is structured, they've made the majority of I don't know about the majority, but there is so much excess labor in the world that
I see what you're saying.
They've tried to structure our economy so that the research and development is done here, but the manufacturing is done in other countries. Well, it was the manufacturing that employed, you know, most of the population of the U.S. You cannot have an economy of just the high-end jobs and the service-level jobs. You destroy, you gut the entire middle class. Mm-hmm. And so that was the biggest bulk of the employed population was the middle class, but they've gutted it.
Yeah. Well, the problem, of course, is if you have a lot of people on the on the dole, so to speak, the incentive then becomes to kill off the population all the more.
And that's what they're going to be doing with the way that the healthcare system is designed. I've said this many, many times, that they have monetized the poor people with the design of the healthcare system. They've set it up so that they can use these people before they die of whatever diseases or experimental treatments they're going to give them.
It all goes back to Joan Vion and her. She was the only one that ever talked about the family dependency ratio at the time that she was talking about it, at least as far as I know. She went to these world meetings with all these world scumbags, and she heard them talking years ago about the family dependency ratio, the number of people in your family that are dependent versus the number of people that are producers. And if you are on the wrong side, the scale tilts in the wrong direction, where you're more dependent than you are productive, then you're going to be targeted for elimination. Now, here we are today, where society, the healthcare system, as you point out, is being built in such a way that if you are not producing, you know, maybe you get a handicap that causes you to not produce, or you get an injury, or you get a serious sickness. You know, what we're becoming as a society
of
ants.
Or you get old.
Or you get old, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the big thing, because everybody's going, if they don't get one of the other things I mentioned, they're going to get old age.
Yeah.
That's the disease that nobody can avoid, you know, unless you get something else that offs you first. And the thing is, gosh, you know, we're becoming a society of ants. I mean, you look at the ant kingdom. These creatures are, all they do is work. Day and night, they work, 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 work. And if one of them gets injured, what does the other ones do? The other ones come and they sting them to death and carry them off and use them for whatever purpose they use them for. How are we not becoming a society of ants?
Well, and the thing is that they're even starting vocational training for children as young as 12 years old. Now, why would they do that with such a glut of labor? And it's not just the labor that we have in this country. They're importing poor people. They're redistributing poverty from around the world, you know, bringing them here to this country. And I know what they're doing. They are trying to screen for the world's most intelligent people, while at the same time they are destroying the middle class society, not just because they destroyed the job market, but they are also trying to destroy and divide the society culturally.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have these upper level trendies, and a lot of them, a significant number of them, are not as smart as they think they are. But they are being used as tools against the rest of society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to kind of be a barrier or a hammer against the rest of the society. It's all been engineered.
Yes.
See, that's the thing that just absolutely drives me crazy, is because I see the signs of the engineering. There's nothing accidental that has happened to our society. It's all been engineered, and there is a plan, there is a purpose. And I see what the purpose is. And if you go read the white papers, paper by Mark Tucker, you know, the National Center for Education and the Economy, he has a pyramid in one of his reports that shows what they anticipate, what the design of the economy is in terms of the jobs that are created.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the United States targeted for these intellectual jobs, you know, the innovative jobs, the research jobs, all of this, with manufacturing being done elsewhere.
There you go. There you go.
So I have it. You know, I have it. I have this diagram.
And the pyramid.
And people could look at it. The pyramid. Yes.
Just like there's a pyramid on the back of the dollar bill, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is quickly being eliminated, by the way. You know, and here we see from Zero Hedge, McDonald's is replacing 2,500 human cashiers with digital kiosks. So they don't want to pay people anymore. The government is working to raise the minimum wage to give people a living wage, they say. And here's the corporation's example of that. Now, you could say, and I think you have said, that they would shift to this anyway. Maybe so, but this provides an incentive to do it sooner rather than later, because a lot of times corporations, you know, they kind of go with the status quo as long as it's working with them and they're still profitable. But this is a big kick in the pants once they start trying to jack up minimum wage to $15 an hour or something like that. They say, well, you know, we can't afford to pay that. We're not going to pay that. And so here you got the technology coming in, taking the place.
They have a problem. They're trying to work it kind of like in a migration kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way that you phase things in, you know, when you're converting from one system to another. It is a step-by-step conversion, and they've about reached the point where they can't tell the poor people anymore that it's your fault, you know, that just go get retrained. That obviously doesn't work and wouldn't work. They have to do something. And so this annual income, guaranteed income, is kind of a mitigation. And they know it won't work.
But you know how this is going to go.
Yes, and
it's going to start off.
That's the design.
It's going to start off being something small, and the politicians will use this as a platform for votes, and they'll say, "We need more money for these people. We need to raise up the minimum and make it higher." Just the same thing they're doing with the minimum wage.
Well, don't forget they're going to be getting rid of old people. They've gutted Medicare of the money, and so what's going to be happening is that they're not going to pay for nursing homes. More older people are going to be dying, so they'll save money on the other side. You see, it's a big shift. It's a shift. It's, you know, pulling this lever and twisting this one, and, you know, it's a slow progression. So so the fact that they're doing it doesn't mean that it will last forever. They are changing the society and changing the nature of the population, the whole demographics of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a social program, but it's designed to be an interim program.
Yeah, and here we see from Wolf Street, Amazon to slash jobs at Whole Foods. We talked about how Amazon has purchased Whole Foods a week or two ago. You brought that up on the show. Now we see that they're slashing jobs at Whole Foods. They're going to dump their cashiers and switch to cheaper products. So here you go. They're doing this all to compete with Walmart, supposedly.
They can't compete with Walmart.
Well, I don't know. Amazon is like
a
weed.
They're too small.
Amazon is kind of like a weed.
Not Amazon. Okay.
Yeah, Amazon is massive.
I thought you were talking about the Whole Foods chain.
Well, no, Whole Foods is owned by Amazon. They basically are Amazon now.
Yeah. Well, maybe they're expecting to replace grocery stores altogether. You can just order your groceries online.
Well, it's like that Vicky vending thing.
UPS will deliver them to you the next day.
That Vicky vending thing we played last week. You know, you're going to walk into your store, provide your biometric information as a condition to get into the store, and then pick up whatever you want. There's not going to be anybody that you make contact with, maybe. There might be a greeter that they pay there, or it could just be a cyborg. Who knows? You know, but somebody will probably be standing at the door to make sure that you give the proper information, you're properly authenticated. Once you get in the store, you pick up what you want and you leave, and your account's charged. I mean, this is where I can totally see the writing on the wall with this thing. It's just
right.
Remarkable.
And is it a society for the population base that we have right now? No, it is not. It is not a society for the population base for the majority of the people in the world. It's not a workable model of an economy for the majority of the world's people. And because it's corporations, you know, the idea that corporations are going to pay for all of this, or that nonprofits are going to mitigate for the loss of income and everything, it's like what that young producer said. That's adorable. It's not going to happen.
Yes.
You know?
Very well said. You know, with all this Russian hacking meme nonsense, and it is just that nonsense, we have real threats going on that are not being talked about because evidently they don't draw in the ratings. And one of those is a good example of this. RT reports China launches new generation 10,000-ton missile destroyer in Shanghai. So they're continuing to get, and this was just from the 28th, so just this week, China has floated out a new domestically built guided missile destroyer, which boasts advanced weapons. The Chinese military says it marks a new step in the development of the country's navy. The 10,000-ton A new generation destroyer was presented during a ceremony at the Jingnan shipyard in Shanghai on Wednesday morning. The new warship is the first of its type and is a quote-unquote milestone in the development of Chinese military equipment, according to the official Chinese People Liberation Army newspaper, China Military Online. Built by one of the two largest shipbuilding companies in the country, China State Shipbuilding Corporation, the warship has, quote, new types of air defense, anti-missile, anti-ship, and anti-submarine weapons systems, unquote, China Military reports. The news outlet adds that the vessel has strong air and missile defenses, as well as advanced maritime target attacking. So they're continuing to advance while the West sleeps, while the West invites them in. You know, and Trump is very China-friendly, as far as I can tell. You know, so while the media has this big smokescreen over the Russians, it's the Chinese we need to be worried about. So we had go ahead.
The policymakers are looking from the point of view of a global system. So the United States as a country doesn't mean anything. It's not important as a country. Our country is going to be finished as a nation state because the globalists are looking at the world as a single unit that they want to manage, that they are going to manage. And during the next 20 to 25 years, it will be just a slow cannibalization of whatever was America as a country.
Yeah, and that really makes me sad. I mean, profoundly sad.
Because it does me too. You know, you and I, a lot of us have worked on this for a long time, trying to wake people up. And you know, this is going to sound very cynical, but I've started thinking, you know, maybe this is just nature's way. You know, nature in the animal kingdom, the old animals, the weak animals, sick animals, the, you know, whatever, they end up dying because they can't take care of themselves. And maybe our society is just too decadent or propagandized, you know, like we were talking about earlier. They're too zombified, whatever. They have lost their instinct for survival. They don't seem to recognize the peril that we're in and what's happening to the country, not enough to get up off the couch and do something about it. So maybe it's nature's way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't really argue with you. I hope you're wrong, but I can't say that you are
wrong.
I do
too, but I just don't see that people are seeing the whole big picture. They might see one little angle of it, but they make no effort to try and understand the whole thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, our audience, of course, is different.
Right.
They are trying to understand and share information and figure out what's going on, but every time I go to, like, the grocery store or wherever, there's just a whole lot of people out there that it's like they're totally clueless, absolutely clueless. And if they do have an inkling that something is wrong, then they just shrug their shoulders. What can I do? Can't do anything. Tell me what to do and I'll do it. And, you know, and that just makes me crazy, too. What do you mean, tell you what to do? Why do I have to tell it? Nobody told me what to do.
Well, the thing that bothers me is that I've encountered this mentality in the Patriot realm, too. I mean, people, that's what really bothers me more than anything. I learned over the course of doing this broadcast that there's a lot of these followers, for lack of a better word, in the Patriot movement. I mean, people, I don't know, something about them, they just tend to find Pied Pipers and follow after them. It's the, you would think that Patriot people would be wiser to that than others, but apparently that's not the case. Some of them are, you know, but not all of them. There's a lot of them that aren't.
Yeah, but, well, I do have to say that you can't really do a hell of a lot as an individual. You do have to belong to groups, but you have to be a leader in a group as well as a follower, so that you can make sure that you're not being led off the cliff.
Well, you're right. You have to lead yourself and never give up your critical thinking and let somebody else do the thinking for you.
Absolutely.
And that's the key. I mean, that to me isn't really following. That's cooperating. That's going along as long as the direction that you're headed is the right direction. Working together is one thing. But blindly following and trusting somebody to the point where, like you say, they lead you down the cow path and over the cliff is an entirely different story. But
yeah, that's true.
Anyway.
You're right.
So, Trump met with this Narendra Modi in Washington, D.C. this week. And I got some audio here. The Indian prime minister, ahead of the meeting, the prime minister, there was this Hudson Institute thing that you found. And I did clip some audio from that. You want to cover that?
Yes. Yes, I do.
It was a discussion on U.S.-India trade relations. Giving opening remarks, of course, was Representative George Holding, who is a Republican from North Carolina.
India is only our ninth largest trading partner, and our trade deficits with respect to both goods and services with India remain for some unnecessarily high, especially as India continues its exceptional growth. But I look at these figures and ponder what else can be done to further develop our economic bonds.
Okay, key word here, Vicky, is economic bonds, as in shackles.
Yeah.
What can be done to further our economic bonds?
The Tom Donahue is the president of the Chamber, U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Uh-huh.
Years ago, when I probably around 2005 or so, you know, when Lou Dobbs was doing all of that, all of his reporting on outsourcing and the importation of H-1Bs, Tom Donahue did a program that was broadcast on C-SPAN, and he actually said, quote, "Why should we breed them here when we can get them over there?" And he was talking about IT people, you know, H-1B visa holders, programmers.
Wow.
Yeah. I just, when I heard him say that, and I did write an email to Lou Dobbs. His producer was Bill, can't think of what his last name was, but he emailed me back and he said, "Where was that?" And I gave him the link to the program on C-SPAN. So I know Lou Dobbs produced, it's in, I guess it was CNN that he was on at that
yes.
time. Yeah, so CNN has that in their archives, I'm sure. But yeah, why should we breed them over here when we can get them over there?
Wow, what a colossal scumbag. But that's how these people think. You know, when you listen to them long enough, they're really quite open about what they're planning on doing. And that's what's amazing about it is nothing is really hidden. If you really want to know, you just listen to them and read what they write. And they lay it all out there, just like he's laying out here, that we have a huge trade deficit with India. And, well, he wants to do more in this regard.
On the trade front, our nations are certainly no strangers to some good discourse, as I mentioned earlier, with one another at the WTO. And hope springs eternal for continuation of earnest talks on a bilateral investment treaty, which has been on the back burner for a while, but which a number of us are urging to get back onto the front burner. From the companies that I speak with, any trade or investment agreement would be more than welcome to get capital off the sidelines from all the relevant companies and by giving investors additional confidence that it's a good place to place their money. This would also have the added benefit of paving the way for follow-on agreements concerning a variety of sectors and industries. Specifically, in the technology and innovative space, I believe we have an incredible opportunity to further integrate our economies, companies, and even our governments.
Integrate our economies and integrate our governments. Gee, I thought that was a conspiracy theory to say that a one-world government was being created, and here we have these people openly conspiring to do it.
Yeah, I know. And where is the outrage? Where is the reporting on that? Integrate our governments.
I'll tell you where the reporting is.
You are fake news.
That's where it is. Tell you what, we're at the top of the hour already. We'll continue this on the other side of the break. Stay with us, folks. Hour number three of Govern America is straight ahead.
Crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is the third and final hour of Govern America. It continues to be the 1st of July, 2017, as we are getting right back into it here, talking about the situation with the meeting of the Prime Minister with the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, between him and Trump, and some of the correlating think tank discussions that were going on. Not the least of which is this Congress critter who we played before the break.
This would also have the added benefit of paving the way for follow-on agreements concerning a variety of sectors and industries. Specifically, in the technology and innovative space, I believe we have an incredible opportunity to further integrate our economies, companies, and even our governments.
Integration. Pieces coming together to form a whole. If you look up integration...
Yeah, you know what? I don't know if you picked up this clip, but a little farther into it, one of the Indian guys, I think I can't remember whether he was with Tata or which guy he was, but he said that India has been closed because of a trading company that came to trade and took over their government. And, of course, he's talking about Britain. Britain and the Raj. The way that Britain conquered countries was to conquer the administrative state. And if they didn't, if a country didn't have an administrative state, then Britain built one, and that's exactly what's happened to our government. Is that our government? There has been a coup d'état on our government.
Yeah,
it was an administrative coup d'état, and they are. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of American employees Bill Clinton let go, but he basically contracted out our government in the whole redesign of government thing. And, you know, they hired Indians. So that's why we have so many foreigners working supposedly inside our government, but they aren't really government employees. They're contractors. And
yeah.
I'm not even sure at this point that we have a government.
Yeah, it's definitely in transition at the very least.
Yeah, oh, and another thing too was that he said that there are tremendous opportunities in the research and innovation yeah. or innovative space.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what I said about the design of the economy, was that the economy was being designed for the very high end, and the taxpayers pay a big percentage of that research. That research is done at universities. And so our American students are paying for an economy that they'll never probably be able to participate in.
Yeah, and it's that outline that he's giving there with the technology is exactly what he said would help facilitate the integration, both of our mm-hmm. economies and our government, just like you were saying there. So technology is the center of it all. I mean, this really put it into high gear.
Yeah, they lay it right out. And all you have to do is to listen to that forum. And they're quite open about it.
Yeah,
a lot more open
it's
than
pretty
they
amazing.
Were when I first started looking at it. Even though one of the very first research projects that I did was on a guy named Harris Miller. And an article that I found, an Indian named Andre Premje, I think. He was an engineer in San Francisco. He said that the movement of Indian IT people into the United States, at first it was a stealth move. Okay, so he basically admitted right in that article that it was an act of war, basically, on the American people, but it was facilitated by politicians, mostly the ones in California and Massachusetts and North Carolina, you know, the three tech centers, or I guess you could include Georgia in that too, but the tech centers of our country. So it's been technology against all the rest of the economy.
Yeah, there you go. Well, he goes on to speaking of technology, he goes on to talk about smart cities and cybersecurity as areas where the two governments can cooperate.
I'm thinking cybersecurity. It will be the innovation economy that will allow the U.S. and India to jointly develop the solutions required to overcome challenges right over the horizon by unleashing the world's most innovative companies. Whether you're world's most innovative companies, whether you're in Silicon Valley or Bangalore, these are staffed with incredibly creative people and talented workforces. And this collaboration will also help further assist the Prime Minister in achieving and realizing his visions for programs such as Digital India and the Smart Cities Initiative, efforts the United States government should also continue to robustly support with its expertise and resources. And if we're going to be able to foster an ecosystem that enables the U.S. and India to become even better partners in technology and the innovative spaces, I believe we can realize even greater business and economic synergies. Now, we all know about companies that have driven this impressive growth, a number of which, almost all of which, or everyone on this panel is a part of those companies, I believe. But there's also such great potential for technology and innovative partnerships in the defense and energy sectors, some of which are already being realized.
Yeah, and we have this agreement, this press release that you found from Lockheed Martin, where they're announcing that you know, Lockheed and Tata Advanced Systems, one of which the person, a representative from there, was on that panel. Now, I didn't clip any of his audio, but they signed a landmark agreement affirming the company's intent to join hands to produce the F-16 Block 70 in India. The F-16 Block 70 is ideally suited, they say, to meet the Indian Air Force's single-engine fighter needs. And this unmatched U.S.-Indian industry partnership directly supports India's initiative to develop private aerospace and defense manufacturing capacity in India. This unprecedented F-16 production partnership between the world's largest defense contractor and India's premier industrial house provides India the opportunity to produce, operate, and export F-16 Block 70 aircraft the newest and the most advanced version of the world's most successful combat-proven multi-role fighter. They say the F-16 production in India supports thousands of Lockheed Martin and F-16 supplier jobs in the U.S. So,
yeah.
Making it over there...
Did we really think that?
Making it over there evidently increases our jobs over here somehow. It creates new manufacturing jobs in India. Well, now that it does do. And positions Indian industry at the center of the most extensive fighter aircraft supply ecosystem in the world. Anyway, it goes on from there. All of this stuff, by the way, will be in the show notes, as always. But, I mean, here you have an example, again, of them talking out of both sides of their mouth. I mean, they say that, you know, they try to make the case in here, in this hearing, that, well, it's not all one way. Well, maybe not completely all one way, but mostly, I mean, there's you know, they'll point to one company that has some of its workforce, maybe even half of its workforce, they claim, over here in the United States from India. But an overwhelming majority of our corporations are going over there. And
yes, and they have been for a long time. Well, they're trying to create a global economy with distributed corporate processes. You know, that in that article it said manufacturing jobs over there, supply jobs over here. Well, I worked on a system that was an inventory system. It's mostly done by computers. Mm-hmm. And if they're manufacturing over there, then the parts picking would be done over there, right? So mm-hmm. you really wouldn't – what jobs are they talking about being over here? If they're IT jobs, they'll be done by Indians over here because of the H-1B visa program.
Right.
So it's a double dip for India.
Yeah. Yeah, and this serves to fulfill – implementation of Agenda 21 once again, because this is all redistribution of wealth, changing consumption patterns, and shifting everything over to so-called developing countries, like they talk about. All right, more on the expanding work on renewable energies. Supposedly, this will help both economies.
But in the meantime, we also need to be prepared to further expand our collaborative work in the renewable energy sector, as these technologies will only increasingly become more important to the energy mix of both of our nations. And all of this, like our bilateral trading relationship and defense cooperation, stands to contribute to the economic success of both of our countries. But more importantly, this type of cooperation stands to bring our two nations closer together, which always must be the shared objective at the end of the day.
Now, isn't it interesting that we're talking about this stuff on July 1st, where our Independence Day is right around the corner? Independence Day is this coming week. And yet, here we have all this talk about integration and bringing different economies together. It's such an insult. It's such a slap in the face. It's such a stab in the back. Whatever metaphor you're so happy with, to suggest that we're independent of anything anymore. When you've got people selling us out in government and in our major corporations.
Yeah, well, you know, a huge... one of the things that I found when I was researching this quite a few years ago was that there is a U.S.-India PAC in Congress. I mean, there are members of Congress, mostly Democrats, that are in India PAC, and they support the interests of India. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that have voted for all the H-1B visas. And a big part of it was the propaganda campaign saying that, I can't even remember all of it. Americans are getting old, they're lazy, they're stupid, they stink. I mean, you know,
they have
the list
bad
goes
breath.
On. I mean, there were a number of years that, when I was on the internet, I was at total war on the internet fighting off the trolls and
wow.
You know, fighting to define what free trade really meant. And
well, and I think you still have that.
Cato Institute, funded by the Koch brothers, were amongst the biggest enemies of the American people because they were promoting the concept of free trade and importing H-1Bs was a good thing.
Well, and, yeah, and here you have the libertarians. Again, we come back to the Libertarian Party platform. Now, I haven't read it lately. Maybe it's changed. But back when I did read it, you know, in fact, I read this on RBN when we were on there. And because I think a lot of people call themselves by certain labels and they don't really know what they're labeling themselves. There's a lot of freedom-loving people who are not in favor of all this free trade stuff that they call themselves libertarians. And if you read the Libertarian Party platform, at least I'm assuming it's still the same. They're all about open, you know, the free movement of goods and services and, you know, all the stuff that we're always talking about, the free trade stuff that, you know, makes borders unnecessary and undesirable. I mean, that's the whole
right.
purpose of free trade. And people think that, well, you know, free trade means government's not going to be involved in it. And so anything that government is not involved in is a good thing because it means freedom. Free trade does not mean freedom. There are certain things that you need to do to protect yourself as a nation. Otherwise, you will cease to be a nation. And that's where I think a lot of these libertarian types miss the mark because they're all about eliminating borders and eliminating because they think that borders are a creation of government, which I suppose borders are a creation of governments. But if you really believe that, where do you live? Where do you live? Do you live in an apartment or do you have property? Many of these people own property. I would suggest that if you really believe in eliminating borders, how about you just tell your neighbor, hey, guess what? Let's pull up these stakes marking our landline here and let's just eliminate this border between you and me. Let's all come. In fact, let's do this for the whole neighborhood. Let's all come together in commonness and just see how it works out. Hey, in fact, yeah. Let's eliminate the whole concept of property altogether. Let's just all of us share all of our belongings all together. Just lump it all together. And see how well your property, what you used to call your property, is respected by somebody else when they're using it. Because I don't know about you, Vicky, but when I got stuff that I own, I tend to take care of it. Because you know what? I had to put sweat and blood and effort into getting that thing. And so I tend to want to take care of it. When it's communal property, guess what happens to it? It ends up like
Darren.
Yeah.
There are poor people in the world that have never owned property, and they deserve a turn. So you should just give up your property for them.
They're not going to own it anyway. And I come back to the metaphor about the police car. Hey, the community owns it. You're the community, right? So get in it and drive away. See what happens to you.
Yeah.
You won't get very far, I guarantee you. In fact, you probably will end up with several bullets in you.
Oh, no doubt.
Anyway. So
I want to go back to smart cities for just a second.
Sure.
Okay, on my old website, I have an article called The Big Blue Monopoly. And I have a picture of the smart city. And the smart city has this image of the smart city. It has a number of icons on it that all represent systems. And these systems, the ultimate design is for all of these systems to be integrated, okay? The systems include the healthcare system, the public safety system, energy and utilities, education, social services, traffic, rail, retail, airports, and all communications. It's interesting how they did this. They have communications on the other side of the river that runs around it. It's kind of like a moat, how they have this city set up. But with all of these systems tied together, it becomes a total control grid.
Hmm.
And that's what they have in mind. That is what smart city means. It means that they will control your use of energy, whether it's you're talking about your use of a car, your electricity and heat in your home. They will control your health care, whether you get it or not. Social services, you know, they will keep track of what social services, and of course the education system.
Yeah.
Absolutely the education system.
Naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they've got to be able to figure out your net worth. And with all this information, if they have all this information on you, they can figure out what your worth is. And if you're not contributing more than what you're taking out of the system, regardless of what pot you're taking it out, it doesn't mean necessarily welfare, but, you know, maybe you use more electricity than they think you should.
Well, it could be something as simple as, guess what, your carbon footprint is damaging the earth, and so to justify your existence, you have to do X, Y, and Z. If you're not measuring up, your carbon footprint is too high. We need to eradicate you. We need to eliminate you.
Maybe your vehicle.
It doesn't have to be anything legitimate.
Oh, no, it's just total. It's just a number.
You're a useless eater. From their standpoint.
Yeah, if you drive a big car that's a gas guzzler and you like it because it's comfortable, it's a total comfort car, but you're not producing anything to offset the gas guzzling beast that you drive, well, you might get into that net negative area.
Well, it's just like Al Gore, you know. I mean,
yeah,
he flies all over the place. They had the day of dimming. Where everybody was expected to dim their lights. And Al Gore's lights, you know, I think the Tennessee Valley Authority probably has a special a plant just to supply Al Gore's mansion. 'Cause,
you know, that's probably true. He's got, I forget, what, 17 rooms or something?
I don't know. But hypocrisy is just off the scale. Anyway, former Pakistani ambassador to the United States, Hassan Haqqani, I guess is how you pronounce his name. I probably butchered it, but who cares? He's a scumbag anyway. He spoke to the goals.
Just to give you a measure of how things are moving, the U.S.-India defense equipment trade was only $200 million in the year 2000. Today it stands at about $15 billion with potential for much more. But as the world's largest and the sixth largest economy, there is considerable room for further growth.
Mm-hmm.
And the World Bank annual report for 2017 on the ease of doing business globally ranked India at 130 out of 190 countries. If there was greater ease of doing business in India, perhaps even more American companies would head to India.
And how wonderful would that be? Hey.
Yeah, wouldn't that be just great?
So that's the goal.
You know what? I was listening to one of the guys, and he was talking about India's space program.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about that, and I was, you know, what an upside-down world in terms of values. They have people there that live in just abject poverty, no education. I mean, it's just horrendous, the most horrendous conditions. And they're spending money on a space program?
Yeah. Well, maybe they'll launch all the impoverished people out into space. What I was really kind of hoping is...
There you go. That's what I mean, monetizing the poor.
What I was kind of hoping is some of these rich scumbags who are doing it all to us, that they'd launch themselves out in space, and we'd be... the problem would kind of take care of itself.
Could that contribute to gas money for that mission?
Exactly. I think we'd all like to get behind that effort. Anyway. So, the goal. Get companies to move to India. As you just heard. He goes on to give a breakdown of four companies that play a major role in U.S.-India partnershipping.
Before we get started on a discussion, just a very quick rundown on the four companies represented on the panel and their business interests in relation to India. G has doubled its investment in India and delivered $3 billion in economic value over the last 5 years. New investments are mostly in manufacturing. They invested $250 million as part of its Indian expansion in 2006, have a factory, $200 million factory in Pune, India, employs something like 13,000 to 15,000 people in India. Boeing investments in India include a new factory which plans for Super Hornet fighter aircraft, and it also has an active footprint in India for helicopter production. Boeing is doubling its sources from India and works with Tata, TAL, and Hindustan Aeronautics, and the sourcing is roughly $500 million of parts built in India for Boeing around the world. Also a major employer in India. Wipro, on the other hand, has a very large number of employees in the United States. Half the employees in the United States are locals for Wipro. It has over 150,000 people employed here. So those who think that this relationship, and of course in the political rhetoric that happens a lot, jobs are all going the other way, no. India is actually creating jobs in the United States as well.
Sure.
And bringing the Indians to go with them.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, to suggest that this is not a one-sided affair is just absolutely the epitome of dishonesty.
It's a takeover of the administrative state. And they use the British model. And, you know, I was thinking about it. The City of London, I think we talked about this before, the livery companies that
yes.
have the patent on trades. What those companies are service companies, or you could call them benefit companies. I believe they call them charities that actually direct or control the businesses of that industry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they've designated the United States to be a service company providing public safety for the world.
Hmm.
And the administrative state administering the administrative state in the United States will be done by the Indian Raj.
Security for the entire world. You mean bombing them into smithereens?
Yes.
That's very secure.
We usually call it America as the global cop.
Yes.
Well, that's basically true, but the way that it will be structured is that as the United States as a livery company providing the service of security to the world.
Yeah, I think most of the world would probably say to the United States, tell you what, why don't you keep your security? We'd like to keep our country intact.
Well, what they're really doing, they're sending our young people out to be chewed up in a meat grinder.
There you go. Perfectly said. All right, we're at the bottom of the hour already. One more half hour to go. Stay with us, folks. This is Govern America, Vicki Davis, Darren Weeks. We'll be back here in just a moment. All right, we're in the home stretch of the broadcast right now. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks, and it continues to be the 1st of July, 2017. By the way, we're going to be returning live on July 17th. just so you know. So July, I don't know what's going to be going on next week, but we'll have something here in the way of a best of show, and then on the 17th of July, we'll be back live again, Lord willing. Anyway, moving along here, we've been talking about this U.S.-India partnership meeting. You know, the president met with the prime minister of India, and we've had all these panel discussions going on at the same time. I got a couple more clips from this, and then we'll move on, because I also have some Elaine Chao stuff that you know, I clipped from your some of the things that you found, Vicky. You know, of course, this is something that you called to my attention as well. But we've been talking. The attention turned to Danny O'Brien. Danny O'Brien is the government relations leader at General Electric. He talks about recruiting Silicon Valley youngsters to move a little further east, as he puts it. Just a little further to Bangalore.
GE, as you mentioned, is a 125-year-old company. Our relationship with India has been in place for decades. And you mentioned a facility that we have in Bangalore, which is somewhat at the heart of our innovation story in India. GE is going in the direction of the industrial internet. That many of you may have seen some of our sort of quirky advertisements on TV over the last year in regards to trying to attract young, smart IT experts from the Silicon Valley area to move over a little further east to our GE Digital company, which has opened a few years ago.
Just a little further east. You know, when I first heard him say that, I thought, oh, you know, they must have had something right, you know, near California, near Silicon Valley. No. He's talking about Bangalore. You know, it's remarkable.
Part of our GE Digital and our innovation push hinges on, is centered on a facility we have in Bangalore. And I was going to update one number that you mentioned earlier. GE now has 21,000 employees in India. So the trajectory since you last checked has even improved and gotten better. But in Bangalore, we have a few thousand engineers, researchers, scientists working hand in hand with the research and development programs that we have here in the U.S. Our facility, the John Welch Technology Center in Bangalore, is probably one of our most modern, and it's certainly our most integrated operations, where we bring all the different 6, 7, 8 GE businesses together to develop applications that will serve across the board through something we sometimes call the GE Garage. In other words, a way to access technology in one industry and apply it to another. In India, some of our results that tell the story that the ambassador just mentioned are simply, we recently last year opened a new wind farm in India that is using turbine blades that were developed in Bangalore. Those blades were developed in Bangalore for the Indian market, but they're in markets all across the globe on every single continent right now. So technology, innovation, collaboration coming out of Bangalore is not only serving the Indian market, it's helping GE in its global reach. In addition, in Bangalore alone, we've had 3,200 contributions for patent applications here in the United States. So GE writ large benefits from the human resources, the energy, human the ideas, resources, the intellectual capacity, the dynamism of Bangalore in India. Not only as we expand our reach around the world, and we're in about 180 countries right now with customers, but we also are active, engaged, resolving issues, coming up with solutions for the Indian market.
So, you know, they open these digital hubs, and, you know, I've got the press release here. It'll be in the show notes. GE opens global digital hub in India to accelerate digital transformation for industry. And they're also doing this in other places as well. I've also got a thing here where GE opens global digital hub in Hungary also. So they're opening them all over the place. Where is the benefit to the United States? I mean, it's just not there that I can see.
I don't know. I've talked about this before, but the way that the design is for this global technology grid, you notice he said the industrial internet.
Yeah.
What the way that the design is working, as far as I've been able to discern it, is that the smart city, the technology systems for the smart cities, they want to have foreigners to the country actually control those systems, the hubs, you know, where all of those systems converge, the fusion center hubs. And in doing it that way, you have foreigners controlling the lives of the people who live in that domestic area. So that's, you know, that's why they're bringing in foreign direct investments in the United States to develop the hubs here. Now, my guess is that GE is trying to lure American students over to Bangalore.
What it reminds me of is these department stores that have their air conditioning on in the wintertime. And the heat on in the summertime, and and people say,
yeah, well,
the customers complain,
systems right.
The employees complain, and the store management says, sorry, there's nothing we can do about that because our climate system is being managed in another state. It's being managed in an entirely different location. We can't have the air system managed locally, it's got to be managed somewhere else. And this is what you're describing for our economy.
Yes. It's a way to ensure it's a way to ensure control.
Mm-hmm.
So that the politicians, nothing domestically can interfere with the global control. You see?
Yeah. Well, then there was the U.S.-India Business Council event, where the Indian ambassador to the United States was interviewed. His name was Navtej Sarna, and he described the meeting, meeting his prime minister and with the U.S. business leaders. A meeting, by the way, I have to point out, that was facilitated by the Trump administration. Mr. Make America Great Again, Mr. You know, we're going to have jobs, jobs, jobs. But he facilitated a meeting where U.S. businesses are being courted by India for investment. In other words, outsourcing of U.S. jobs to that country.
Why, exactly, yes.
Why would the Trump administration...
Foreign direct investment.
Why would they be facilitating a meeting like this where our multinational, our big corporations can be preyed upon? I mean, look, if they want to talk, they can talk. If the big corporations want to talk to the Indian government, hey, they can do that. There's nothing to, I guess there's nothing to stop them. But why hold a meeting to facilitate such outsourcing if you're really committed to keeping jobs in the United States?
Right, because it's like a total fraud. We were talking about the meeting of the National Governors Association in 2011, where they invited communist Chinese governors, their equivalent, over here to make connections, personal connections,
right?
You know, for soliciting foreign direct investment.
Yep.
They want communist Chinese to invest here and American companies to invest over there.
The crisscross double cross, as you call it.
Absolutely.
Yep. Exactly. Well, and that's the problem. All right. So this guy, this whatever his name is. Anyway, he's commenting about this.
Well, one of the things that you did was to bring the CEOs that John referenced earlier together with the Prime Minister on Sunday, and you brought together a fantastic group of CEOs from the United States to sit down and dialogue with the Prime Minister.
We did have Ultimately, it was 20, the number of CEOs who were around the table. And they represented several key sectors. There was the information technology sector, very prominently present. There was the retail. There was the infrastructure people. There were the financial services and banking people. And there were the consultancy companies also. And I think I kept trying to do a mental calculation as to how many billions we had in that room, but I gave up after a while. The Prime Minister himself was in an extremely interactive mood. So he did start off with introducing some of the recent reforms that have been undertaken, prominently the major taxation reform of GST, which you heard mentioned from President Trump also yesterday in the press remarks. And I think the broad feeling that we got, it was very, very impressive and moving and humbling in many ways to hear major companies, global companies saying India is the place. I mean, Apple mentioned a figure, if I'm not wrong, and they said, we've got on our platforms 100,000 apps that have come out of India. I mean, that just shows you the kind of innovation and the scale. I think Amazon mentioned a figure of, I think, 300 million made in India goods on its platform.
And go India.
Similarly, I mean, there were several companies who were seeing India as a major theater of their business, who were clearly acknowledging that the reforms have begun to bite, that the ease of doing business has improved. And as the Prime Minister himself said in his closing remarks, that maybe all of you are being very polite and are not saying some things which you should be saying to me. But I think I think they did say what was truly in their minds and in their hearts. So it came out of it as a very optimistic meeting, a meeting which showed that the direction that the Indian economy was taking was on an upward trajectory. And certainly in terms of foreign investment and production, development, innovation, I think we have perhaps only just begun to grow.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Go India.
Yeah.
So much for America
and
first.
And our members of Congress are doing absolutely everything they can to help them. And you know what? It's not just India. They are trying to set up this global system in all of the countries.
Sure.
And over in the Middle East, they've had just a terrible time getting the infrastructure installed over there because the people in the Middle East didn't want it.
Hmm.
They didn't want the internet. They don't, you know, there are longtime rivalries over there. They don't want pipelines coming from this country going through their country.
Well, how could they want to not accept the Matrix? How could they not want to accept that? You mean they don't want smartphones and they don't want connectivity? They don't want this?
Well, they do want the young people do want the smartphones. That's how they call forward the rent-a-mobs. You know, State Department provided cell phones over there. I think it was in Syria that I was reading about where in 2009, Obama provided Obama phones to the people in Syria so that they could call forward their mobs.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to find my Obama phone, lady, but I couldn't do it that quick. All right, so anyway, since we're running out of time, I probably should step it up. Hearing in Congress on how to finance infrastructure projects. Of course, your friend Chairman Chao was there making the case for putting the country up for sale.
I'm concerned that...
This is Nita Lowry, a Democrat from New York.
President's plan lacks actual funding and instead would put a burden on state and local taxpayers to pay for those programs. This would be particularly catastrophic in a state like New York, which gives more in federal tax dollars than it receives from the federal government. You remember hearing that from Senator Moynihan, who documented that many years ago. So if New York is getting less in tax dollars and giving more, already pays some of the highest taxes in the country, it would be unfair, in my judgment, to force New Yorkers to pay for even more, particularly when many infrastructure developments and economic gains in New York benefit the economy of the entire nation. Do you have more details about how President Trump plans to pay for his infrastructure plan? And how will you ensure this infrastructure plan doesn't force states and localities to raise taxes to pay for federally directed projects?
The president has always emphasized the need for new infrastructure, and he has talked about $1 trillion. $200 billion of that would be direct government funding. Some of the monies will come from sale of public assets, and then the remainder will be a combination of partnerships and cooperations between the public and the private sector. And through leveraging up through use of the federal dollars, which will be like used to like a seed capital that will allow more innovative, more creative financings, and that leveraging through public-private partnership is actually very often seen. Right now, we have certain states that don't allow the private sector to fund public infrastructure. And so we want to be able to let the private sector come in, and if they want to, fund public sector infrastructure projects. And if there are ways in which they can participate that will help alleviate the burden on taxpayers, I think that's something that we should welcome.
The taxpayers are still going to pay for whatever they come up with, number one. Number two, did you catch the part, and I know you did, about seed money? You know,
that's
the federal
right.
government's part is going to... So this is the same model that we've seen elsewhere, where the government is choosing winners and losers and providing capital. Go ahead.
Yeah, what they've done is, in the budget, they've mandated $1 trillion worth of projects for which the government is going to fund $200 billion. Leaving $800 billion for the states to figure out where to get that money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a major scam, you know, continuing on here.
And I know that my constituents would be very upset if their taxes are going up to pay for responsibilities of the federal government. It just doesn't make sense to me. So I'd like to continue this discussion, because most people today who responded to President Trump were people who said, I'm tired of paying taxes that keep going up and up. And President Trump was very forceful about infrastructure, creating jobs. So I don't think they knew when they responded to his comments that they're going to pay for those infrastructure.
They're going to pay either
projects.
Way. If it's $1 trillion in direct government funding, that's taxes.
That's taxes, but it's the federal responsibility. And when you see all these cuts that we have in the domestic side of the budget, there's a real concern.
So, which is why we need the private sector to be involved, so we can leverage their input and their participation as well.
I am delighted to have the private sector involved, but I don't want the, frankly, the responsibility for these major infrastructure programs that the president talked about and how he was going to create jobs fall on the tax base of our local citizens.
Okay, but either way, whether the private sector's charging you for certain things or whether it's being charged in a form of taxes. Either way, that's one thing Elaine Child did say that I agree with, one of the few, is that either way you're going to pay for it.
Except, okay, let me explain to you what the problem is. The problem is that they are leaving it to the local taxpayers, which means that they're going to jack up your property taxes, probably, or state taxes,
to pay for
roads. And the thing is that they're it's not really even paying for roads and bridges. It's paying for the IT systems.
Well, I'll tell you where we're going to go with roads. We're going to go to more toll roads. In fact, they mentioned that in this. There's Representative Harold Rogers, who is a Republican from Kentucky. That issue came up with him.
I noticed on page 2 of your statement where you list the key elements of the infrastructure plan that will involve 13 federal departments and agencies in concert. The first principle that you list is that the monies would be made spent on the most transformative projects. Well, tell me what that means.
I think the president would like something that is bold, that is innovative, something that will really speak to the future and address the concerns of the future. Having said that, I understand your question, and that is you're concerned about rural America.
Yes.
And I come, as you know, from a state that is very rural, so I am concerned about access, ridership, and the ability of rural America to be part of the American dream as well. There will be a separate title to the infrastructure proposal that will address rural America. The dollar amount has not yet been decided, but we are very cognizant of the needs of rural America.
Where is the center of the effort to finance study how to finance the infrastructure improvements? Where is that research going on? Is that in your department? I'm asking who is studying that portion of the problem?
The White House,
yeah.
All of us. Prior to your arrival here, we talked about various different ways, that there's a plethora of ways, 13 to 17 different very commonly discussed ways to pay for infrastructure. As of yet, no decision has been made, no agreement, I should say, has coalesced. None of the payment forms are ideal. At this point, suffice it to say that nothing is off the table. And as you mentioned, there are about 16 different government agencies around the infrastructure task force that's grappling with how to pay for all this.
Well, given the financial situation of the country and of the states and localities, it's pretty plain that the money to do whatever we're going to do has got to come from somewhere else, i.e. private sector. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and again, in an effort to be bipartisan, I understand that our colleagues, our friends on the other side would prefer 100% federal funding of $1 trillion. And I had just said that unfortunately that would increase our deficit quite a bit, and it would actually also create some havoc within the private markets because it would be such a large presence of federal dollars. So the president is looking more toward using $200 billion in direct federal funding in infrastructure, using that as seed money, and selling off some public assets, and using the federal amount to entice or to partner more with the private sector in some creative, innovative public-private partnerships, which we have seen in the past.
Yes. There's examples of this. For example, Indiana, several years, 10 years ago or so, sold the cross-state toll road for billions of dollars, and then use those proceeds to build the roads around the rest of the state. Is that a possible way to go here?
Toll roads certainly are an increasingly popular way to finance infrastructure. But I am also cognizant, as I mentioned, I understand both sides, that some Some people may not like toll roads, but it's a very effective way to finance new roads.
All of us don't like toll roads. But some of us may tolerate tolls.
Okay, well, there's more to that. But, you know, unfortunately, in the interest, we're all just about out of time. It's just remarkable. You know, we've got the situation in Illinois where their $130 billion pension shortfall, you know, there's a threat to shut down infrastructure maintenance such as roads and bridges repairs. The lottery's threatening to leave the state, you know, because without a state budget, they don't pay out the winners. And so, I mean, the situation is ripe for a complete privatization move in a number of states. And here we have it, a perfect harmonious mess that's been created for us to work in favor of pushing the infrastructure privatization. And we come back to George Bush's executive order, 12803, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, sell off everything. Sell off U.S. assets. And sell uranium to Russia.
And we didn't even have time to get into the FAA and the selling of the air traffic control system, the privatization that's going on there. And maybe we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Well, on the privatization of the roads, you know, setting up toll roads, we as taxpayers already paid to build those roads.
That's right.
So what they're talking about is really repaving them. In terms of the actual road. So where the money is really going is in the IT systems to be able to tax us by the mile or, you know, giving a profit opportunity to a toll road operator. So it's all part of the privatization and the fleecing of the American people.
Exactly. Well, on that happy note... Again, doses of reality, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we give you every week. We'll be back live here again on the 17th of July. I don't know what we'll be doing next week, but you can tune in. Something will be here, probably a best of show. And then on July 17th, Vicki and I will be back live, Lord willing. In the meantime, pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. And God bless you, folks, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Vicki.
Thank you.